Yeah, look, we know we're good. We also understand that, you know, they're really good, and there's a lot of good teams out there, and we got to continue to, you know, take care the things that we can control. You know, it's how we go about our business, how do we prepare day in and day out. It doesn't matter who we're playing. Yes, this is a great team, and they knocked us out last year in the playoff. But, you know, we like our chances against anybody. That's the bottom line here. We know we're good, but we got to play. We got to go out there in between the lines. You know, it doesn't matter how good you look on paper. The baseball is something that is hard to predict. So still early. It's May. But it was good to see the guys bounce back, especially after that game on Friday, and take a series from there.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on Monday, May the 26th, 2025. Happy Memorial Day, of course. I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets No G, and don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. Of course, we're coming to you here on this Monday morning, Memorial Day. Hope everybody's had a great weekend, great sports weekend. I, of course, might have got off to a little bit of a rocky start on Friday night with the double whammy with the Knicks loss and the Mets horrible, probably their worst loss of the year, extra inning loss, but both of those teams have rebounded. Maybe the weather hasn't been the best, but it's been okay. It's a chance to kick back, relax, get away from the grind of life, enjoy some food and family, and of course, let's put a bow on this unofficial, start of summer, Memorial Day weekend with the Talking Mets podcast. It's finally here. The long anticipated wait. And it's funny because I was thinking about this. We always do this, you know, about the first third of the season-ish. And we talk about it as a chance to get to know the club, to get to know who the Mets are. We call it the getting to know you phase. Kind of goofy, but it works, and we've been doing it for years, and it works as we try to dice up the season. So we finally, today, I thought, as I was watching the games this weekend, I was like, all right, I think we need to bless off on it. We always talk about Memorial Day. Maybe it's a little bit after, but Memorial Day is that first checking point. So I'm going to give you kind of like the state of the union on who the Mets are. It was a wild week for Juan Soto. I know you're tired of talking about it, but I thought John Heyman wrote a couple of things, or there was a couple of interesting points in his column. We'll get into Soto because that's going to be a big part of the Mets as we get into the meat and potatoes of the baseball season. And of course, we'll start to think about what this team needs to get to where they want to be, which is navigate the National League and potentially get into a championship situation. So a lot to talk about here. And, of course, hopefully while you're listening, you're kicking back, you're having a burger, you're having a hot dog, you're enjoying whatever's left of the weekend when you grab this show, and away we go. So, to start off, what a difference a year makes. If you remember, about a year ago at this time, I basically was advocating for the Mets to blow this thing up. I had waved the white flag. They had gotten off to an awful start. They had, I believe, the Jorge Lopez glove-throwing situation. The Dodgers picked them apart at Citi Field, ironically, just about a year ago around this time. And I said, look, you've got veterans like J.D. Martinez and Brandon Nimmo, and even Lindor, who, it's funny we're talking about Soto being unhappy. Think about his return to Cleveland last year in May, when I believe the Mets got swept, and how it looked like he was reminiscing about how much fun his time in Cleveland was, and how, really, let's face it, things were not going as well in New York. And what a difference a year makes. The Mets turned it around. The Mets did not sell. and they nearly made it to the World Series. Now, I had said this in the offseason, and I think one of the first things that has really come to the forefront of 2025, and I think this is more for the fans, is that because of the uniqueness of 2024, how the emotional pendulum swung from one end of the spectrum to the other, and the off-the-field or some of the fun, goofy components of 2024, like Grimace and OMG, which, of course, Jose Iglesias, who's out in San Diego now, no longer is around to really spearhead those things. The playoff pumpkin, the drama of how they navigated the Brewers and the Phillies. And let's face it, one of the biggest hits, even though it was a regular season hit, the home run by Lindor, to really shatter the yoke. And that was one of the big things going into the offseason. The Mets had shattered the yoke, and then they doubled down on that to sign the biggest free agent, not only in their history and baseball history, but last year was filled with all this newness, these liberating and fun and all-time stories that 20 years from now, similar to how, you know, Mets fans talk about maybe, you know, some of the those like me who grew up in the 90s talk about some fun moments and fun seasons and fun teams, even though they didn't win. You know, you're going to be remembering Grimace, OMG, the playoff pumpkin, Lindor's Grand Slam for a long, long time, and that's okay. But when the page turns and the new season comes into play, that's in the closet. And I think a lot of fans have wanted to recreate somewhat of what it was, an innocent climb, with this 2025 crew, along with the expectations of being a championship contender, which immediately happened, even though one player does not necessarily change the course of a championship trajectory in baseball. It's not the NBA. It's not a quarterback in the NFL. In Soto, it didn't matter. The Mets were on that trajectory. So I look at some of the commentary, and maybe it's like I said, there's a quarter of the fan base that I think is toxic. I don't think they necessarily watch the sport for the right reasons. I think they're mired in negativity. I think they like the yoke because in a sport that's over 70% failure, your emotions can be much easier managed by feeding into the failure because you're always going to be right. I mean, there's a high chance if you're going to take the negative or the under in baseball, you're going to be right because of the amount of failure. And in some ways, early on, it reminds me because even though the Mets won 100 games in Buck's inaugural season here in 2022, and yes, they did lose the division, and the Braves played at an incredibly elite level, 98 Yankees level from pretty much Memorial Day on. The Braves won that division. The Mets didn't lose it. Every single loss, every single two-game losing streak was met with panic, and this is a collapse, and here we go. And I think there's still a small percentage, I think albeit much smaller, because the vibes at the ballpark, and I will be at the ballpark later this week. I'm actually going on Wednesday. The vibes of the ballpark are so much better. I think that's still the undercurrent. And I also think fans that aren't like that are yearning maybe for the fun of last year. And when you have an innocent climb scenario, which that really was because it was Stearns coming in, Mendoza as a manager, Lindor and that core really breaking through on the big stage in New York, you never can recapture that. Now it's about going forward and executing. And I think this team knows that they're good. I mean, John Harper even wrote about it after the win against the Dodgers. I think they're very businesslike. I think they're very focused on a goal. And I'll even look at, you know, the Knicks, for example. I know the Knicks are still in a ton of trouble in their series against the Pacers. But you know, similarly, they had an innocent climb in 2024. And then they upped the ante. They brought in some big-name stars. And those stars were trying to figure out, and it's a different sport, how to piece this thing together. But in a lot of ways, the Knicks, especially because they have a leader in Brunson who is very Jeter-like, you know, very matter-of-fact, you know, very focused and determined and very much about the process, just like the coach, their success is boring. It's about on to the next, on to the next. Not necessarily the surrounding fun that sometimes sports is about for the fans. It's not about for the players. And when you're playing at that top level, that's what it really becomes. That's what the Yankees have always been about. That's what the Dodgers have been about. At times, that's what the Red Sox have been about. The Mets have always been about drama, have always been about amazing and believe and these tremendous stories. And that'll always be part of their history. But to be frank, championship competent run teams, well-run organizations, they start to become almost like, you know, it's like death and taxes. That's what you expect. That's what they need to do. And it's not always fun. Now, winning is fun. When you win, it's fun. When you win a championship, it's fun. I can't promise you that you're going to win with flair. 2024 was a season the Mets won, but they won with flair. I don't know if they're going to win with flair. And I think in a lot of ways, Soto and Soto's personality, who he's just there playing baseball. I don't think Soto's into the pictures and the preening for the cameras. I know everybody wants to talk about the Soto shuffle and, you know, whether he's doing it or not. I mean, that's just ridiculous, that whole thing. I don't think he's into that other stuff. I think he's probably a serious guy. And that's okay. You know, that's not what you brought him here for. That's not what you paid him here for. But I think that that's been an undercurrent here in the first half. That's more of a fan thing. That has really nothing to do with the players or their success going forward. But I think it was a theme, and I think it's important to really, as we head into the meat and potatoes now of the baseball season, now that Memorial Day is hit, I think you got to put 2024 in the closet. You really do. I still see some grimaces out there, and that's up to the fan to do that. You want to come to the ballpark and do that. You got to put 2024 into the closet. You really do. So now that we did that, now that we kind of addressed maybe the little bit of the fan elephant in the room, who is this team? Who is this team? And what's interesting is that they're on a 95-plus win pace. And everybody's been panicking because they've been pretty much a 500 team for a couple of weeks. Really some bad losses ever since that St. Louis doubleheader. And I can even go further back to some of those botched games by the bullpen in the Washington series late April, early May. It's always, you know, there's been this like, you know, you don't feel good about the team. But that's the perspective on the grind. Even when you win 97 games, I mean, the 1990 Mets, a beloved team, one of my favorite teams in Mets history, won 97 games, had to go to a 163rd game to beat Cincinnati to make the postseason. They had a couple of losing streaks. I think they had a 9-game losing streak and a 7-game losing streak throughout the season. Bobby Valentine almost got fired in June. They were like 0-16 over a 2 or 3 week span during the season, and they still won 97 games. So it goes to show you the ebbs and flows and how long a baseball season is. But you got to like a lot of what you see about this team. And the things that are bothering you, I think, are fixable. So first off, the thing that you can't fix easily and the thing that ultimately will decide whether or not you're going to win, and John Harper talked a little bit about the Mets' approach to the Dodgers' offense, their aggressiveness, you know, making them beat them a little bit, hit the baseball. But the starting pitching has been excellent. Whether you want to go through traditional stats, advanced stats, whether you want to use Baseball Reference or FanGraphs or whatever your favorite, you know, site is, the Mets starting pitching grades out top 5, top 6, top 7 in all of baseball. And nobody could have predicted this because they didn't go out and get a Corbin Burns. They didn't go out and get a Blake Snell. They didn't trade for Dylan Cease or Michael King. You know, they weren't the Dodgers and have Yamamoto and Glasnow and basically, you know, maybe potentially Ohtani coming back to pitch. They had names like Holmes, or converted closer, a failed, you know, Angels reject in Griffin Canning, who was dumped by the Braves after they acquired him in a trade. They had a tease the girl with the curl in Tyler McGill, Kodai Senga, who can never stay healthy. And oh, by the way, going into the season, the two big names that, you know, from Oakland, from the Oakland days that you brought in to be those vets at the top of the rotation while you were figuring out the Holmeses and the Griffin Cannings and whether Senga could stay healthy, and David Peterson, you know, who is he? Montas and Manaea, they haven't thrown an inning yet in regular competition. That's how amazing it is. So, you know, you look now with Montas and Manaea working their way back and how good Peterson getting into the eighth with what was described as a big boy outing against the Dodgers a day after the bullpen was burnt, and how Senga many, many times has not had his best stuff but has been finding a way to win. And when he does have that ghost for going, take it from someone who sat behind home plate a couple of weeks ago and saw it move. It is a lethal, lethal pitch. And by the way, this Clay Holmes, who the Yankees resurrected in the bullpen as one of the better closers in the game, wow, does he know how to pitch? Does he know? And he has tremendous Seth Lugo-esque feel to him, top of the rotation. And the Mets got him on a bargain, and they're probably going to have to compete for his services again this offseason, because I'm pretty sure if he stays healthy, he's going to opt out. And maybe the most surprising of them all is this kid from Anaheim, you know, 29 years old, and is stuck in the middle of his prime, a guy who pitched really well against the Mets, has some elite secondary pitches, not such great fastball. They have looked at his repertoire, and they've been able to work backwards, and he's been able to navigate 2.5 times through a lineup. And I know the Dodgers, with the rain delay, got him a little bit, but that's okay. I mean, that happens. To be maybe at times their best pitcher. And I know everybody's down on Tyler McGill, and there's those inconsistencies, but he is pretty much giving you who you thought he was. He's going to give you very Steven Matz-like. Probably at the end of the year, he's going to be very league average, maybe slightly above, maybe a tush below, because of the bad outings and the bad stretches and the inconsistencies. But when he's on, he's giving you every bit the top of the rotation performance that you could ask for. And when you have that out of a guy in the 4 or 5 slot, and McGill, that's what he is right now, that's a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous weapon. I mean, think about how the Mets were back in the day when Matz was pretty much that guy. So you look at that, you have one of the critical components, most critical components of a baseball team set. You know, it's there. And I know that we were talking about potentially going out, and as the deadline got closer, there'd be all this discussion around Sandy Alcantara, you know, bringing in a big name. And I quite honestly, unless something with the health drastically changes, I just can't see that being where this team goes, especially because it's going to cost them. Even with Alcantara struggling, he's still got a very, for an elite pitcher, with something inside of him being elite. And let's face it, Miami probably would be trading him from a sell-low perspective. It's still going to cost you some top prospects. And you've got you know, some really interesting arms. We talked about that last week, late in the week, when we did our special Talking Mets top pitching prospects. You got your, you know, McClain's and Wenigers and Jonah Tong, and who knows, you know, what's going to happen with a Blade Tidwell and a Brandon Sproat and guys like that. So you have some arms on the way that may actually be, you know, bullpen arms in the short term. But I don't know if you want to go out and start ripping up the farm system for a Sandy Alcantara. And if you look at the other top arms in the league, there really isn't the old school Scherzer bulldog, give me the ball and I'll go 7 or 8 innings type of pitcher out there that's going to be available. I mean, some of your top pitchers in baseball, I mean, Nathan Eovaldi, I know some people talk about Jacob deGrom. I just think that's a pipe dream. You know, guys like Skeens and Wheeler, they're pretty much locked in. Hunter Brown in Houston, I mean, maybe Framber Valdez becomes available. Maybe. I just don't see that. You know, Mitch Keller's not going anywhere in Pittsburgh. I mean, I'm looking up and down Logan Webb in San Francisco. These are the top starters in all of baseball. Tarik Skrubel, Detroit's not putting him anywhere, at least not yet, not now. You know, they're not available. So, Alcantara's the one name to keep an eye on. Struggling, of course. I'm certainly thinking that the Mets would jump in on a buy low scenario. I just don't see how Miami would do that, because when they trade a Ozuna or a Yelich or a Giancarlo Stanton at that point, you really got to be able to bring back talent that's going to help you cost controlled contribute pretty much quickly, or be at least an asset to help you have some. I mean, if your goal is to actually have a competitive baseball team at the big league level, not just, you know, constantly win prospect ranking championships. Yeah, you have to be right. I just don't know if Alcantara would be that guy. And he's obviously the most obvious name out there. And I don't know if that's where you want to sell those assets. So I think that the fact that you have the starting pitching in a good spot is huge. And to me, that's why I've been bullish about them, even throughout the struggles by the offense. Now, the bullpen took a big hit with Minter. I think that's a bigger loss than everybody thinks. Not only was he a backup closer who had experience in the postseason, he was left-handed. He could be used to get big lefties out. I don't know if anybody in the bullpen right now, and I know Reed Garrett had a good outing and got through the Dodger lineup, and Brazoban has been really, really good in getting big outs as well, and has been a little unlucky in his opportunities to close in the days that Diaz hasn't come in. But everybody that's in there, the Stanics, the Reed Garretts, the Brazenbond, even Max Kranick, who pitched some high leverage innings yesterday, a hittable guy, doesn't walk, you know, throw strikes, but a hittable guy is going to be one of those guys that if the BABIP starts going against him, he's going to get knocked around a bit. All those guys reek of sixth and seventh inning, some margin of error needed type of relievers. You don't have, and it's funny, we've talked about this, and maybe this year, especially as they got off to a better start and Diaz was struggling, it begins and ends with Diaz. As much as the starting pitching is great, and we'll get into the offense and Soto and scoring runs, at the end of the day, no matter what the Mets do, it's going to come out to come down to those three outs of the ninth inning with Diaz. And guess what? You'll find those arms, if they could, the ugliness of last year's bullpen, with all the walks that were part of last year's bullpen, and the roller coaster ride that last year's bridge, and even Diaz was at times, if you were able to navigate and survive with that, and Stearns was able to go out and get Phil Maton and Ryan Stanek and figure out some things, I can't see why he can't go out and get himself a useful bullpen arm. Who knows? This Castillo guy, this lefty, some of his metrics on the advanced side look pretty good. I know he's, you know, been ugly in terms of some of his big league numbers. So maybe they stole another arm. Who knows? But I have confidence they'll go out and they'll find that arm. I really do. The biggest and best news out of this bullpen happened about a week ago and then was doubled down against a really good Dodgers lineup on Friday and then on Saturday. Got out of a real jam on Friday and looked old Diaz on Saturday. I know he's not throwing 99-100 all the time, but if he's throwing his fastball at 97 and he's pinpointing his slider, whether it's 90 or 88, and he's locating those pitches and throwing them for strikes, I don't need the extra 2 miles an hour because no one's going to hit him. And to have Diaz, and maybe that at-bat against Judge was a turning point because we hadn't seen him. I know he got big outs in the postseason. He got Schwarber to send the Mets to the the NLCS against the Dodgers. He did get a save in L.A., against the Dodgers as well. So it wasn't like he was chopped liver in the postseason. The postseason was, you know, he did have a blown save in Philly. But in a lot of ways, that's utilization of Diaz. Let's remember that. I think the fact that you may be seeing Diaz return to the guy that you had in 2022, maybe not with the same invincible flair, maybe the trumpets don't feel the same, but a closer that could come in, miss bats, and if he throws strikes, that really at that point, you've got six innings figured out. So you've got 18 outs figured out. You've got three outs figured out at the end of the ballgame. You're trying to figure out six outs. And you have a better ability to navigate those six outs than you did probably in the last few years. You just need to figure out how to get a better level, higher leverage, maybe backup closer type, more certainty. Because I think maybe some of those bullpen arms are overplaying or over-indexed right now versus what they could be. You know, maybe there's a little bit of that variability and luck and things like that. But that's, again, I think that's a fixable thing. The starting rotation, not so fixable. The bullpen, very correctable, very fixable. And look, your core offensive players, I know Soto has some of the worst numbers he's had in his career. Imagine a player with a 120 OPS plus being like that. Alonso and Lindor are still who you think they are, smack in their prime. Alonso playing for a contract. Maybe the power is not the same, but the overall game has improved, and that's a good thing. I think you sometimes have to look at the positives in there. You may have finally an emerging star in Brett Beatty. I think ultimately there's a lot of bad luck. I mean, the Mets are hitting the ball hard, and the metrics indicate that they are extremely unlucky. They should be one of the top two or three offensive teams in the sport, and they're not. They're very much average, and there's a lot of brownouts that are going on. Putting that aside, because to talk about that is very difficult, I think the real concern with the offense isn't Soto. If you're concerned about Soto being Soto, now, is there a possibility that he has a 2005 Beltran, a 1992 Bonilla type of down year? That could happen. First year in a big contract. I'll get into Soto on the way out here. I don't want to make this about Soto. Still very unlikely. Could happen. And if his floor is 120, 130, 135 OPS plus. That's still a really good player. Not what you paid $50 million for, but not a player that should be looked at as the problem. You have an emerging star in Brett Beatty. Very excited to see if this can be sustained. Nice lefty bat. His defense at both second and third has been really good. I mean, he's amazed me at how much he's improved at third base. He is unrecognizable on a positive note from where he was just a couple of years ago. I've been critical of the guy and the guy's ability in a fast game. He looks sometimes like the game is too fast for him. He looked like he was the ultimate bust. This guy has been through the gauntlet, maybe even more so than Vientos. I know Vientos had his things, but he was, you know, a top prospect, the number one pick, sent down multiple times. It looked like he was on his way out, got sent down after hitting a home run off of Zach Wheeler. A lot of ways his story this year resembles what Vientos went through. So has he emerged? Is he ready? You know, we'll see, but there's a lot of positive signs. The concern you have with the offense isn't necessarily with your big three. And I think maybe Beatty falls into that. The concern is that you may be seeing, and again, I told you guys about herniated discs in the neck. Maybe you're seeing Nimmo's injuries catch up with him, and now he's a below league average player. Maybe he cannot be a very good outside or core offensive star. Marte is continuing. Maybe he hits lefties a little bit well, but Marte doesn't look like he has much left in the tank. I know he's providing really good leadership for Soto and Vientos. There was an article written recently about that, and I'm sure that veteran leadership is something the Mets don't want to just jettison out the door. You know, this is not a Cano situation where Cano is coming back from a PED suspension, but at some point, that's some of the soft parts of the lineup is where you have, on the roster, quite honestly, is your Martes. What kind of player is McNeil? Is he the, you know, the 800, 820 OPS plus, you know, Daniel Murphy type, or is he going to start, you know, spraying the ball around the field? Sometimes you get a little bit of both with him. Had a big hit on Friday. You know, he's done pretty well since coming back from the injury, but, you know, we'll see. We still kind of, he's a weird tweener, McNeil. You don't really know what you're going to get from him. The real problem you have now, and the real concern you have with the offense, and this is where the ultimate decision may come down as you get closer and closer to the deadline. And what better day to start than here on Memorial Day against the White Sox later today? But your younger players, your Vientos, your Alvarez, and your Acuña. Now, Vientos falls a lot into the Mets offense where he's hit the ball hard and hasn't seen results all the time. Alvarez and Acuña are a little different. Acuña definitely provides you tremendous value defensively and with his versatility. And if all he is a backup around the infield defensive glove, kind of like an Iglesias type, maybe hits against lefties a little bit, I'm not going to complain. Anybody who thought he was his brother, that was foolish. That was never on the table when they acquired him. Vientos is a guy that, you know, is he a seven hitter? Is he a guy that's going to wreck bad pitching but struggle against hard throwing? Or forget about hard throwing, pitchers who spin and know how to locate and send him, give him a healthy diet of off-speed stuff and struggle. I mean, we've seen some of that. I mean, what was it? Cruz of the Yankees last week. I knew he wasn't going to hit him late in the game. I could tell by the way Cruz set him up. You know, the only way he's going to hit a guy like Cruz out of the bullpen, the Yankee bullpen, is if he gets a fastball that the pitcher misses. You can't rely on that. That's a lower part of the order hitter. It's like a seven hitter at that point. So who is Vientos? Because that wasn't the guy that we saw in the postseason. That's not the guy we saw from Memorial Day on last year when he got called up, when it looked like his Mets career was coming to an end. So that is something that, are these hard hit balls going to start falling? And does the presence of Beatty, and maybe, honestly, taking the defensive component out of it, and I know it's going to throw both a Jesse Winker when he gets back and a Marte into no man's land, to a certain degree, although you may need them more than you think because of Nimmo's health. I think putting Vientos at the DH spot, letting him just be a hitter, his future's probably Schwarber-esque. I've said all along, I didn't think his defense was that bad last year. I'll stand by that. I thought they could survive with him at third. I'll stand by that. Now I'm not so sure. I don't know if the offense is has hurt the defense or it's a slump, but you know, it always works this way. It looks like the ball is finding him. So a lot of things Vientos has to prove between now and the trade deadline. And look, ultimately, and I'll talk more about it over in the premium content and beyond the mic, but Alvarez is a guy that is, and I've said this going all the way back to September, and you guys know it, when down the stretch I advocated for Torrens to get more playing time. Alvarez is playing himself into, similar to Beatty, into a demotion to AAA. And he has shown no ability to prove offensively. He's actually regressed on the one thing that he was good at, which is his power. He talks about, you know, evolving as a hitter, working with J.D. Martinez last year, changing his swing. And then he goes and he swings from his heels. He's a very easy guy to pitch to. Yes, he has a decent arm, and I know that the pitchers like throwing to him, and he's good at framing. And, you know, with an automatic ball strike, that might not matter in the future. But honestly, Torrens is a better hitter. Torrens is a better catcher. You know, Alvarez doesn't block balls that great. I mean, not that Torrens does either, but, you know, so it's not like there's every component of the defense. You're not getting, you know, Johnny Bench defensively behind there. And he's not hitting. And Hayden, if you're going to get a light-hitting catcher, you're better off going with the better defensive option. I know this was brought up on X with Hayden Senger. And it would send a message to Alvarez. So we'll talk about that more. That's not what this is about. But I think Alvarez is part of that. And, you know, the thing about the Mets improving the offense, if you say the Mets need to go out and get an impact, you know, similar to how the Giants brought in a Chris Bryant, or, you know, I know you're not going to like hearing this because it's really going to tie in. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago. Can the Mets bring in their Javier Baez in a better spot, someone to spark the offense? Knowing that you're going to have to probably give up some kind of painful prospect, or, and I'm going to throw this out there, you might have to give up a Vientos and Alvarez or even an Acuna to improve the offense at the deadline. Did you think about that? You didn't think about that, probably. And that's where the next 6 or 8 weeks are important. I think with Alvarez, if Torrens is going to start getting more of the playing time, now they see him on the back end going down. Not that I think AAA is where the numbers will matter a hell of a lot. He'll hit down there. If he doesn't, you got more problems than you know. But him to just go down there and just work on whatever he's working on. You cannot work on a new swing and trying to figure out what kind of hitter you are, you know, evolving the way that he's supposedly trying to evolve while a team's trying to win a division, trying to win a pennant. It just can't do it. It's not possible in that way. As an everyday catcher, certainly at that point. So if the Mets are going to go out and, you know, and this was the problem in the offseason, there's only so many areas that they can improve. They can go out and maybe find a second baseman. You know, Beatty could be at, you know, depending on how Beatty plays, that third base or second base might get locked up. I think Beatty ultimately should be a third baseman, so maybe that's all already been spoken for. They could go out and look for a hitter that could DH. You know, certainly with Nimmo's health, and obviously in center field, I know Taylor's done a nice job subbing in, but he always profiled to me as more of a fourth outfielder and series glove only, maybe a center fielder. A name like Cedric Mullins has come up. You know, you're not going to do anything in right with Soto. You're not going to do anything at short or first base. I don't think catching is where you go. So really right now, where this team goes and to improve the offense is twofold. One, the young players I just brought up, along with Beatty, all figure it out and hit at a level that you expected them to hit coming into the season. Vientos comes and looks more like the Vientos of 24. Beatty evolves into a really solid, starting third baseman. I'm not saying he's going to be a 30 home run star, but a 110, 115 OPS plus guy. And, you know, everybody else falls into place. You get your Winker contributions, your Marte contributions, you know, maybe Marte against lefties. Soto becomes Soto. And with all that already on the table, and all that's there, like that potential's there. That's not a crazy thought. The team should score 5-plus runs, and with their pitching, they should be fine. And then you could go out and find yourself a bullpen arm. But, you know, that's going to be a really tough call as you get closer and closer to the deadline, depending on who falls out of the race, depending on what bats become available. You know, you could certainly look at center field regardless, because right now with Siri and Taylor, and hopefully it'll be a defensive-minded player, because I think that's really part of Stern's DNA, is defense up the middle, and center field is critically important. I believe in that. You know, you're going to have to look at, as you get closer and closer, whatever those guys produce, even if they start to get hot, is it sustainable? Do you see things that you and I don't see, that you and I can't just glean from the Baseball Savant page or the Fangraphs page, that indicate that the names I gave you, those young players, are capable of producing as maybe not a core offensive player in the next gen of core offensive players with Alonso and Lindor and Soto, but as a very good surrounding, maybe borderline all-star just underneath, very good offensive player? Because if you look, you know, the Dodgers have the Muncies of the world, and then when he was there, the Gavin Luxes and the Pies, and you know, I'm talking about the guys, you know, Teoscar Hernandez, you know, maybe he's more of an all-star, but you know, you need those kind of guys around the stars, like the Freemans, the Otanis, the Betts. You need those guys. But, you know, do the Mets have those guys right now? Is Nimmo's health a bigger issue where you have to go out and get yourself a veteran bat, corner outfielder or something like that, and maybe de-emphasize Nimmo? We'll see. It'll be interesting. So the good news here is this is a team that knows it's good. This is a team that right now, in a very crowded top of the National League, maybe the bottom isn't good, but the crowded top, the Western teams, San Francisco, San Diego, obviously LA are good. The Diamondbacks haven't gotten on track yet, but you know, you saw with the Mets last year being around 500 right now doesn't mean that they're out of it. And they have good starting pitching. They have some good offense. The Braves have been eh, but I wouldn't discount them at all. And the Mets are going to see a little bit of them in June, as well as the Phillies. It'll probably be the Mets and the Phillies at the top of the division. Phillies had a really soft schedule. Now the Mets get to benefit from their soft schedule. I really think the Cardinals are maybe now. Let's see how that Central shakes out. At the end, it'll probably be those strong Western teams with the Mets and maybe Atlanta. And there's going to be one or two teams, like last year where the Diamondbacks were not part of the party, that are at the end of the year going to be out, who probably are going to say, I deserve to be in the postseason. And if the Cardinals continue to play at a high level, and maybe the Reds or Milwaukee start to play like, you know, maybe some thought they could. You know, Milwaukee was a 90-plus win team last year. Well, you know, then you got yourself a really congested, crowded scenario. You have to beat the doormats at that point. Beating the bad teams will become even more essential when you're in a scrum like that. Because the Mets could be a 95, 96, 97 win team, just like they were in the late 90s under Bobby Valentine. And at the end of the year, fight for their lives to get in the postseason. See, last year they were a high 80s team. So you kind of expected that. If you win 87, 88 games, you should make the playoffs, but you're probably going to have to fight that final week. When you win 95-plus games, you shouldn't have to fight. I don't know. You know, they may have to still fight a little bit, this Mets team. So we kind of now know who the Mets are. Good starting pitching, dominant closer, really good core offensive players, trying to figure out what the rest of these young players can contribute, and are they the answers, and are you ready to sacrifice some of their potential to win this year? That will be a big theme going into the trade deadline. Like every other contending team, you could shore up the bullpen, but I think it may be what the biggest surprise is. I didn't have the Mets as a top five starting pitching team. I thought their starting pitching would be okay like it was last year, although down the stretch, while they made their run to the postseason, it was very good. So I shouldn't say that, but I thought they'd be more about their bullpen, about their bats, and doing just enough with their pitching. Their pitching starting to creep into the sixth and seventh inning and giving them quality. That's a big deal. So we kind of now know where this team stands. We kind of see where it stands in the context of the rest of the National League. Now it's about sitting back, and I think the biggest story for me, other than the sustainability of what's gone right, is are these young players, Vientos, Alvarez, watching very closely, Acuna, Nimmo, the veterans like Nimmo and Marte, what do they have left? And McNeil, kind of that tweener. It's not about Soto getting better. He's going to get better. It's not about Alonso and Lindor. We know who they are. It's about these other guys. What can they produce? And potential? Because I know Mets fans don't handle seeing homegrown players have success out there. Not saying Vientos will be Pete Carroll Armstrong. That's a unique type of premium position player. But if you traded an Alvarez for a win-now move, or a Vientos for a win-now move, or an Acuna for a win-now move, or even a Beatty for a win-now move, could happen. and they go on, and they're very, very successful, and you got something out of it. Now, if you win a championship, all bets are off, but if you don't win a championship, and you had a fun season and fell short in some capacity, boy, is that going to hurt, and it's something that in this day and age of high payroll, luxury tax, not knowing what the post-2026 CBA looks like, David Stearns has to be really, really careful. And we all know that they have some positional prospects down on the farm, but the pitching is getting more play than the positional prospects. And maybe that's because of their age, and maybe that'll change over the next 12 to 24 months, but that's why they pay the Stearns a big buck. So that'll be a big theme. There'll be a lot of debate and a lot of agita because Mets fans, you're in the deep end of the pool. This is not just a good vibes, OMG grimace scenario. You're in the deep end of the pool. And with that comes big decisions, and with that comes a whole nother level of stress. Like they say, more money, more problems, right? That's the way it is. All right, let's take a quick break. On the way out, a week of Soto, probably the dumbest, most irresponsible, immature media week I have ever seen in my sports fan life, doing independent media life, and that's saying a lot because I'm going back all the way to 1987. So anyway, you're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this.
So it's 2-2. Here it comes. It is a splitter. It's lofted to center. Edman on the run. Not going to get there. Off the top of the wall. Soto trying to unload the bases. Betts' throw to the plate is in time. But Soto delivers a two-run double off the top of the wall.
I've asked you a lot about Soto's hustle or so in the past week. For him to beat out that ground ball in the first, just how big was that? And the running play he had also in the field, just what did you think of his day today?
Yeah, I mean, look, I know he's been a topic because, I don't know, it was a ball of the Green Monster, but the guy plays hard, you know. Even on those days, he's stealing bases. He's going first to third. He's going second home. Like, he's playing the game. He's a winning player. You know, he does the little things. Today, perfect example. He smokes a ball, and not too many people are able to beat that out, you know, because he was hard right at the defender, and he was still able to beat it out, right, and bring speed to the plate. Before you know it, we're up 2-1. He steals a base. He gets a great jump on a ball going back. Like, there's a lot that he's doing that, you know, there's a lot of eyes on him, and, you know, he becomes a big deal. But, you know, since day one, this guy is a professional. He plays the game the right way. I'm just glad that he's on our side.
All right, we're back. So I got to tell you, when Juan Soto signed in the offseason, I said it was going to be interesting. He was hitting .180 early in the year, how the knives would be out. And I expected that, but I will tell you this. I did not expect the level of scrutiny that continues, the immaturity of how the coverage has been, the coping that's going on with, understandably, the fan base, but how the media, especially those that are in the national media, who are really pom-pom waivers for the Yankees and the Dodgers, and then the Yankee media, guys like Michael Kay, the lengths that they will go to justify a narrative that the reason he's struggling is because he really wants to be somewhere else. So let's get this on the table. And Juan Soto and Scott Boras aren't listening, but if they happen to come across this, and I know Scott Boras knows this very well, but if in some way, shape, or form, in the very, very, very less than 0.5%, less than 0.25%, less than 0.1% chance that Soto's saying to himself, I just made a mistake. I really want to be in the Bronx. So I'm going to be miserable for the next at least 5 years, and then probably 15, because if you opt out, you're not going to get that money if you're having a bad five-year run. I'm going to be miserable. I'm getting paid, and I'm going to sit around, and eventually that'll make life better. Guess what? You're stuck here. You made the decision. The Mets are stuck with Soto. He's stuck with you. You're not playing for the Yankees again. There's no chance, unless you opt out in 5 years and you want to go back, you are not playing for the Yankees again. You are a Met for life. I know that's not the case. I don't have to say that. So figure it out. So if that's really the case, if all these things that Michael Kay and Bob Nightingale and how, you know, throughout the broadcast on ESPN on Saturday night, they talk about the Soto shuffle, like all this stuff that doesn't matter. Because you know what I see from Soto from pretty much day one? his timing is off. He's either late or too early. Now, is that a health thing? I can't answer that. I know his bat speed is down. Him being too late or too early in those four threes to second, as a guy who's a lefty, who had not even a quarter, 0.25% of the talent that Soto had, not even 1.1% of the talent Soto has. When you do four threes to second, that's because you're early. His timing's off. Why? I don't know. He was late last night in the ninth inning when he broke his bat. He was behind on a 93 mile an hour fastball. That's not because he's thinking about his mom telling him that he had to go to the Mets. That's not him worried about Aaron Judge. That's not him pining for the pinstripes, or whatever. And the fact that this had legs, and the only reason these legs went away is that the Knicks, I really believe, and their loss in game one and how badly they lost to the Pacers and blew that lead in the final 2.5 minutes. That got Soto and the Mets to a certain degree off the snide. I mean, the Mets game even on Friday, that horrible loss that Soto was part of, was buried. The Knicks did the Mets a great service with how badly those two games at the Garden went this week. Took them off the pages, the front pages. Really. It really has. And the whole, like, well, the Yankees are better off. Well, the Yankees are so much better off with Goldschmidt and Bellinger and Freed, then why wasn't that your plan from the start? Like, if you really didn't want this $50 million a year elite Ted Williams type of hitter next to Mickey Mantle in your lineup, which I don't know why you wouldn't, to tell you the truth, especially in the prime of both of their careers, then why don't you just do it? Instead of like, I didn't want to date you anyway. We were a bad fit anyway. That's rationalization. That's rationalization for something that didn't work out. And the fact that we're perpetuating that we have, you know, reporting. And I love Bob Klapisch, and Bob Klapisch has been on the show, and I have a ton of respect for him. And I'm not saying he's lying, but anybody who says he's not happy and is speculating because it's his family or because he wants to be with the Yankees, you just don't know. Now, putting that all aside, I think John Heyman and his New York Post article, and I think it was a Post Plus, was really where the rubber meets the road with Soto, because there was a lot of comments in there that at the end of the day is the issue coming here. And not only Lindor and Piazza and Beltran have experienced it coming in similar situations, but you want to go to the next level, the page six level, A-Rod and Giambi and even Clemens when he came over in a trade, from 98 to 99. These guys come in with Hall of Fame resumes, tremendous expectations, and have no runway to figure out or have a slump, especially early in the process where they have no history with the team. I mean, Beltran had an awful first year. Outside of his last year when he was shot and maybe his early struggles as a big leaguer in his career, if you go to Baseball Reference, his 2005 was one of his worst seasons of his career. He had the collision in the outfield. I think he had an oblique injury, if I remember correctly. Awful. And then he got off to a bad start in 06. I think he was like 0 for 12 or something, and hit a home run the third game of the season. And Julio Franco had to shove him out of the dugout. Now, ultimately, unfairly, he's remembered for a really elite curveball striking him out with the bases loaded in a game 7. So his career was always kind of marred as a Met. But he was tremendous. He was every bit the MVP in 06, 07, 08. I mean, him with Delgado and Wright and Reyes in their early prime. Tremendous core of offensive players. You know, this team could use some of that. Believe me. Any team, any Mets team in history could use some of that. A-Rod got off to like an 800 OPS start his first month in the Bronx. Giambi. Clemens, like I said, struggled in 1999 quite a bit. That's what led to some of the Piazza situations a year later in 2000. Unless he's done, unless there's something physically wrong, unless this bat speed situation is a health issue that can't be fixed, you can't say New York's not for him because he was there last year. But going back to my original point, the money does change everything. The fact that he went from the Yankees to the Mets, which was going to create an historic seismic reaction, not just locally here, but in the national media. The fact that he's the highest paid player in the sport. The fact that he pushed the payroll conversation to another level, which probably pisses a ton of owners off, set a standard for future elite players. He, for him to say, and for the words, and I'll find it right here, I have the article up, he just wants to get back to playing baseball and being just another player. Yeah, Juan just wants to get back to everyone treating him the same. I know that's what Boris is saying, and I'm sure that's what Soto wants. It ain't happening for a while. And it's not going to happen till you start hitting like Juan Soto. So if you're waiting for that to happen, yeah, you're going to have an 05 Beltran year. You're going to have a 1992 Bonilla year. And in a lot of ways, Bonilla went through it. Bonilla, and I know everybody wants to talk about Bonilla and the worst team money can buy. Bonilla was brought in as a very good player, expected to be Darryl Strawberry, expected to breathe life into the 1980s one last time. The Mets tried to spend money to bring one last gasp of air, whatever pitching they had left over from the 1980s with Cone and Gooden, and they brought in Saberhagen and all this other stuff. They wanted a one last bite at that apple. They wanted to extend the run without the principles that got them there in the first place with the farm system. And Bonilla was expected to be Darryl Strawberry. And he was never Darryl Strawberry. But he is an underrated hitter in Mets history. A very underrated hitter in Mets history. Who had a really bad year his first year in New York under the weight of expectations. Now, a year later, Barry Bonds gets a big contract. And Greg Maddux gets a big contract. And free agency in baseball exploded. But he was one of the first to open up that big floodgate. So there was a lot of burden of expectation. So there is a lot of similarities between Bonilla and Soto. Not as players. Soto is Ted Williams. Bonilla was a very good star next to Barry Bonds and Andy Van Slyke. Bonds was the star. Van Slyke and Bonilla were the stars around the universe there. You know, Bonds was the sun. Everybody else was the planets around the sun on that team. So, you know, him getting back to being just another player, well, that's not going to happen until you start hitting. And guess what? May not happen for a while here. Now, luckily, he's got Pete, big personality, and Lindor, and the Mets are winning. I mean, imagine if the Mets weren't winning. The Mets are a couple of games out of first place. They're one of the top wild card teams. They're on pace to win over 95 games. I mean, imagine that. And here he is, pretty much hitting like Brandon Nimmo. A good Brandon Nimmo year. What he's doing is what you'd expect from Brandon Nimmo. Really. You know, everything clicking, he's Brandon Nimmo. He's moved to the third spot, which ironically, if you read a lot of advanced analytics theories, the third spot in the lineup is not where he's going to produce runs because that's one of the spots in the lineup that comes up with two outs and nobody on the most. I was surprised to read that. After all the elite hitters over the years, the Keith Hernandez's and so on and so forth, that hit third, you know, you find that out, right? And I do think he's going to need some time. I do think he's starting to show a little bit of frustration because whatever he's trying to do, whatever was there that made him elite, is not working right now. I think ultimately, here's how he copes with it. First off, the noise about, which even this morning, I'm reading stuff from Bob Nightingale, which he's saying that, you know, they're still talking about how he wanted to be part of the Yankees. Like, it's like, if you're so much better off, then why are you talking about it? You're clearly not. Here's how I would approach it. First of all, forget what my numbers are this year. I don't care. Stop looking at and reading the scoreboard or the new, if he is. You might go down as not having your best season in your Mets career this year. This might be your, up until the time you decline and become an old player, this might be your worst season. If the Mets win, it doesn't matter. If you give us Brandon Nimmo the rest of the year, and that's the best you're going to do, I know that's not who we signed. I know that's not who we expected as a fan base, who the Mets signed, who we thought as independent commentators here they were getting. But that's who you are right now. Just work on getting back to being Juan Soto. Don't look at getting it all back overnight. Saturday, the big hit with the bases loaded, a ball that can't believe didn't go out. Much different perspective if it was a grand slam versus a double off the wall, but still a big hit. Good start. Big hit. Big hit. Mets needed that hit. Turn the weekend around. You know, they go to maybe on the verge of losing the first two of the Dodgers and having a chance of being swept. Soto goes out there and gets the big hit on Saturday night. It's there. You know it's there. Lindor and Alonso are covering up a lot. The Knicks are going to cover you for another maybe week. We'll see what things go. Because the Knicks are going to take a lot of head front pages, regardless of what happens the rest of this series, good or bad, away from Soto. So you got some time. You got some also-rans with some crappy pitching coming in. So you got a week maybe to fatten up. And then guess what? You get into June, you got some West Coast, so you're going to not be first and foremost in people's minds or televisions. But then you got some big series, Atlanta and Philadelphia. And guess what? You just accept where you're at. Don't worry about the stats. Just be yourself. Accept that this year might not be your best year. Don't try to be a Hall of Famer this year. Don't try to make it all up the last, 7 weeks. Just say, hey, having a, for me, not so great year, but I'm still putting up good numbers. And guess what? You have a big series against the Braves next month. You have a big series in Philadelphia against the Phillies. You get a couple of walk-off hits. Maybe you go to LA in the dead of night when no one's watching and you have a big series. All of a sudden, April and May don't matter. Look at Lindor. Lindor was bad until July, his first year. Then he hurt an oblique, which shot him in August when the Mets were going to hell in a handbag. Came back in September, had a big September, had the three-home run game against the Yankees. 2022 happened, and away you go. And he hasn't looked back, and now he's more popular than ever. Would you have thought, and that wasn't, it was 4 years ago almost, in July of 2021, that the fans would be singing My Girl and running on endless loop his grand slam against the Phillies in the postseason? I wouldn't have. That was a long ways off. You know how many people hated Lindor? And even at this time last year, I was even wondering, maybe try to trade him. Get him out of here. Get something for him. Maybe this isn't going to work. He seemed like he was pining for the good old days in Cleveland when he could just be Lindor. And all of a sudden, things change. So this sport changes a lot. But Soto's wants to be just another player? Well, he's got to accept that's not going to happen, at least not now. Not till someone else knocks him off the front pages on that. And maybe not for a couple of years because of the nature of the seismic shift from the Bronx to Queens. Yankee fans have a huge complex against the Mets since Cohen took over. That's not going to change. There's a generation of fans that grew up believing that the whole universe of their life revolves around Yankee success, that every principle that you could learn from comes from pinstripes. They may root for other teams, but everything was, there was always the Yankees. And now they're learning, well, nothing lasts forever. And pinstripes don't necessarily win games. Players in pinstripes win games. And sometimes players have other things that are important to them than pinstripes. Unlike the Yankee fan that grew up in the 90s thinking and knowing anything but the Yankees, including some announcers like Michael Kay. Let's put it that way. Who, by the way, took time on his radio show in New York, or streaming show, whatever you want to call it, to go after content creators like myself and question, almost their employability, their life, their principles, their integrity. It was the most immature rant. I mean, just like the Yankee fans saying that they don't care about Soto and they're better off. Well, it's like, well, if you don't care, you don't talk about somebody. You don't talk about them incessantly. So, Soto's just got to get back to just forgetting all this. You can't lose the albatross of the contract. You can't take away the seismic decision of going from the Yankees to the Mets. You have to own those things. They're not going anywhere. But you can't accept the fact that, hey, I'm not going to worry about my numbers. Whatever they are this year, they are. Let me just be Juan Soto. And if the booing gets big and the media scrum and the questions start to get too much, try to find a way to compartmentalize it out. That's what I would do. I'd be like, hey, we still talking about this? If I was Juan Soto, and again, with different people, and people started talking to me again, especially as you get into the next Subway Series in July, like, are we still, you have nothing else to write about? I would say, you don't want to write about the fact that my first baseman's having a great year, that my shortstop's continuing to lead this team, that I'm playing the outfield, behind incredible starting pitching, like, disarm them. And I know that might be tough. I'm not saying Soto has English is not, I'm not saying his English is a second language, but there may be some component of that. He's a different personality. I think that comment that you saw in the Heyman article, he just wants to get back to being where everyone treated, to where everyone treated him the same. He doesn't want to be the center of the universe. He doesn't want to be the media darling. He doesn't want to preen for the cameras. He just wants to play baseball and play baseball at a high level. And the problem is, once you get the money, that's not necessarily going to be the case, at least not now. And if he's waiting for that to happen organically, he's going to have to make it happen. Just, he's got to forget about it. He's got to be able to, and he's clearly thinking about it. He was frustrated in the ninth inning when he broke his bat. And part of that might be, oh, I got to listen to the fans now. Oh, I got to listen to the media. Forget about it. It's going to happen. You are going to get booed right now for any slump. Anytime the Yankees have success this year, especially with the players that they brought in, they're going to bring you up. Nothing you can do, short of having the all-time best season, having Barry Bonds 0-1, even then they'll still bring it up, is going to change that. And do I think he's going to be okay in the long run? Sure. Unless he's not healthy, sure. Even Bobby Bonilla, who goes down as a scourge, mainly because of his second act. People forgot the fact that he was a pretty good hitter in 93, 94, and the Orioles thought enough of his hitting in 95 that they brought him in, and he was a big part of their postseason push. And they gave up a top prospect in Alex Ochoa for him. And by the way, he went to Miami, and he won a World Series and got some big hits in the postseason with them. So he went other places and did pretty well as a supporting cast. Now, Soto, because Bonilla didn't get another big contract, and he wasn't the highest paid player in the game more than a hot minute once Bonds and other guys came in to play. Soto's never going to be able to do that. But Soto just being himself, he doesn't have to be OMG Grimace Soto. He doesn't have to, you know, preen for the cameras. Every time the fans go with the if he wants to do the Soto shuffle, do the Soto shuffle. If he doesn't, don't listen to any of that stuff. But realize this, the only way you become part of, just like everybody else, is just ignoring all the other guys, ignoring it. That's it. Because it's not going to happen. They're not going to make that happen. The media doesn't want you to be one of the other guys. By the way, the media would love for this contract to go down Bonilla-esque. They would love it. It would be an ultimate clickbait. The Yankees would love it. The Yankee fans would love it. The Yankees want to justify the fact that they lost out, and that makes them feel better about themselves. Not the fact that they're 12 games under 500 and in first place in a pretty weak American League East. That would be reality. That would be honestly saying, hey, we'd be much better with Soto to win it all. But let's cope and say we're better off because we're in a weak division 6 games up. With a component-driven offense. With a Goldschmidt that's a good hitter, but let's see how much he has left. And with Bellinger, who is very susceptible to long slumps and being pitched to left-handed pitching. Forget about the Little League home run or the short porch home run. I shouldn't call Little League home run that he hit off the mats last week. I mean, that's a fly ball. Happened to be in the right ballpark. So that, to me, is where you're at with Soto. Just accept that you're not going to be like everybody else and get back to just not caring. Don't worry about your stats. Go out and play. Wherever they land, they land. It's year 1 of 15, and if the team wins, nobody's going to care. They really aren't. And guess what? If you told me right now, am I worried about Juan Soto being Juan Soto or Vientos, Alvarez, and Beatty and McNeil and Nimmo contributing to an acceptable level offensively to get this team to offensively support this team in the way they need to be supported in order to win a division and compete and go deep in postseason, you know which one I'm more worried about. It ain't Soto. So you could take what you want from that. All right. Anyway, hope everybody's going to have a great Memorial Day. Ball game a little early today at 4 o'clock. Mets playing a couple of second division clubs this week. Maybe they could take a little bit of a blow, but not take their foot off the gas. Get a few wins, maybe get 4 or 5 wins this week, set themselves up really well for what will be a little bit of a challenging June with some big road trips to LA and Philadelphia. They play the Braves in a 4-game series. So it's and a lot of road games, and it's not going to get any easier. So Anyway, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And don't forget the newsletter. Would love for you to subscribe. Less than a cup of coffee. Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on Fansided Podcasting for supporting the show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. Enjoy your Memorial Day. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.